Earlier this week, we talked about the changes made to the social studies curriculum by the Texas School Board. One board member argued that current standards are rife with leftist political periods and events. In today's Los Angeles Times, Jonathan Zimmerman writes that most of his fellow liberals won't admit that he's right. So let's revisit the textbook discussion. If you teach social studies, do your textbooks tilt? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Jonathan Zimmerman is professor of history and education at New York University, author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory, and joins us today from Audio Post in Philadelphia. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And what in the textbooks leads you to believe the conservatives in Texas are right, that their textbooks tilt left?
Well, they're right insofar as the textbooks, the narrative, is a small p progressive one. It's a story of change over time and indeed improvement over time. There have been lots of misdeeds, and the textbooks are clear about that. We enslaved Africans and displaced Native Americans and oppressed women. But the story the textbooks tell is that different groups put pressure on the state, that is the government, to change our laws and institutions and bring us ever closer to our founding promise. We haven't gotten there yet, but we're getting better. I think that's a liberal narrative.
In the great national drama you wrote, our leaders are supposed to harness the power of government to the principle of social justice, and when they don't, we take them to task. So that that belief in the power of government as a force of good.
Yeah, and also of the social protest that's the engine behind the change, right? So Frederick Douglass and Jane Addams and Martin Luther King Jr., et cetera, they're heroes of these texts because they put pressure on our institutions to change, to progress.
And that is a liberal view and one you say you agree with.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. I mean, it's one I learned as a child, and it's one that I still believe.
And have you checked out textbooks lately? Because when we did this show earlier this week, we got calls from some teachers in some parts of the country who said when they were presented with the possibility of textbooks to buy, all the ones they saw had been published in Texas and reflected views like the country was founded on Christian principles.
Well, I think that there are some books that say that. Obviously, the books themselves vary. Texas, as I'm sure your listeners realize, has an inordinate effect on the process because they have statewide adoption and they have so many people. But I do think that the majority of the textbooks tell what I call a small p progressive story. The idea of the United States as, quote, a Christian nation, that would appear in a minority of textbooks, indeed, probably mostly in textbooks that are published for Christian academies.
So to your knowledge, those are not available to public schools or not used in public schools? Because that's not what teachers told us on the program.
One of the difficulties in studying American education, it's so irreducibly diverse. There are 15,000 different school districts. And so I'm always loath to generalize, but I don't think that many public schools have textbooks that say directly that the United States is a Christian nation in the way that many people on the Texas School Board, by the way, want the textbooks to say. There are plenty of people who want that, but I don't think that a large number of public school textbooks say that yet.
And by the way, if you weren't with us when we talked about this, the vote last week was one part of a long process, and it's as yet unclear what's actually going to emerge in the textbooks that that reflect the new curriculum, whatever that new curriculum may be, because it may be changed as well before the decision date on the textbooks. In any case, what you argue in this piece is that since historians by their nature are going to be presenting arguments and have an agenda, why not present more than one?
Absolutely. You know, I think that one of the things that really frustrates me as a historian is that our kids aren't exposed to what historians actually do. We are not perfect encapsulators of the past because we didn't live in the past. What we do through the best of our ability is to try to reconstruct the past, but we do that imperfectly. And most of all, we disagree with each other in the process of doing it. That's what I find so exciting about history, is that it's a series of question marks. Unfortunately, I think it's rarely presented that way in the classroom. So we have very fervent debates amongst ourselves as a society about what the history books should do and say. We're having one right now.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, I think that debate rarely enters into the classroom. It's as if we don't want the kids to know. It's impolite when the kids are in the room to let them in on the great secret, which is that we don't actually know what happened.
We're talking with Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of education and history at New York University, author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and in Memory. So history teachers, social study teachers, do your textbooks tilt? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's start with Tracy, and Tracy's on the line from Oklahoma City.
Hi, Neil. I nearly choked on my lunch when you said what the subject was going to be today. I'm a U.S. history teacher. I'm an Oklahoma history teacher. Oklahoma's near Texas. And the new textbooks that they come out now leave out a lot of the other side of the history. For example, in U.S. history, it's the same way as when I was growing up. There's no mention of Emmett Till. Malcolm X, civil rights, they give a sanitized version of civil rights. As far as Oklahoma history goes, it leaves out the Tulsa race riots, which happened in
23, I think, yeah.
And they're still the worst race riots in the country. The kids didn't know anything about this. The land runs, they're referred to as, you know, the great land runs, that no mention of who lived here before, no mention who was kicked off. Andrew Jackson, Louisiana Purchase, there's no other side to that. And so my mission when I teach class, I'm not conservative or liberal, but I think that they deserve to know the other side of history. And I think it's still the majority and the winners who write history. And it's kind of my personal mission to let them, I've learned a lot in teaching that I didn't know, because I didn't, my Oklahoma history and U.S. history was much more sanitized even back then. But
mm-hmm.
It still is very, very sanitized, and they don't know all this stuff, and they're eager to learn the other side. And
Do they go to the Internet to look stuff up, too?
Yeah, they do. They do. In fact, when we were discussing Emmett Till, somebody had an iPhone, and we got a picture of him at his funeral, and we went back. We were talking about the civil rights era, and then we had to go back to we went back to Reconstruction, because you can't just take one little bit of history. And all of that history in this year's history book is left out, and it just mentions a little bit about slavery. It doesn't really. It's just the same thing, I think, with history. If you go visit a plantation like I have, I visit historical sites, the plantation told the white point of view, and then it had a shack out back. This was in Tennessee.
Right.
And had a shack out back where the slaves lived, and the tour didn't go back there. And so I walked back there, and it's just kind of run down, and it should be half the part of the tour, I think. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tracy.
I just think I think your guest. I want to read his article, but liberal or conservative, I think he's way off base.
All right. There's a link to his article on our website, so just go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And thanks very much for the call. And Jonathan Zimmerman, I'm just wondering whether this isn't a phenomenon of, it depends on where you are. I mean, those liberal textbooks might be on the coast and maybe not in the middle too much.
Absolutely. Again, you know, U.S. education is a irreducibly local thing. It varies across not just time, but obviously space. First of all, more power to Tracy for doing what she's doing. One of the things I'm uncomfortable about in a discussion like this, focusing on textbooks, is, of course, it leaves out the most important factor, who are the teachers themselves.
Right.
And none of us should assume that because something appears in a textbook, liberal or conservative, that that's what's being communicated or the only thing that's being communicated. But I think even within Tracy's narrative, you do see a kind of progressive narrative. You'll note that she said that when she was a child, her textbooks were, quote, even more sanitized, unquote, than they are now. No doubt the Oklahoma textbooks tell a different story than ones, say, in New York or California. But unlike, say, textbooks 50 or 100 years ago, they don't simply ignore the African Americans or, as happened everywhere below the Mason-Dixon line, demean and ridicule them as less than human. They are inaccurate and imperfect in the ways that the caller describes, but they have changed. And indeed, the story I'm telling right now, ironically, is a progressive story about the development of progressive textbooks.
Let's go next to Kevin. Kevin with us from Oakland.
Hi, thank you. I was a teacher of political science for many years. I'm retired now. I believe it is incumbent upon the teacher to sort of square the record. So I, for instance, would bring up facts like John Adams' attempt to outlaw his political opponents' opinions by making them illegal in order to jail them.
Alien and Sedition Acts.
That's correct. And other issues like labor, I think need to be covered in greater depth than most textbooks will do, because labor rights and individual rights, the basic things we take for granted, things like the 8-hour day,
mm-hmm.
things like
You're saying it's the teacher's responsibility, no matter what the textbook is.
I believe it is, because you cannot fit the whole history of this country into one textbook, or even two textbooks,
mm-hmm.
and you have to bring your perspective to some degree to this whole issue,
mm-hmm.
To enrich the student's perspective, and I have to emphasize that perspective is very important, because if you never knew that employers fought tooth and nail to keep the 8-hour day from
being enacted, yes.
That's correct. And then you wouldn't understand what we're up against today. Why are we having difficulties today?
Mm-hmm. All right.
Labor in trouble in some ways today.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. We're talking about the textbooks of social studies and history projects and political science, as you just mentioned. Do they tilt? You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to Keith. And Keith with us from Ann Arbor.
Hey, Neil. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Love your show.
Thank you.
Listen, I just want to offer a different perspective. First of all, I'm a social studies teacher for 20 years, mostly world history, some U.S. history. I think these textbooks are, if anything, they hew the kind of middle-of-the-road approach. And they're very superficial. Sometimes I wish the books were more liberal or more conservative or both. It might elicit more discussion. But the comment I really wanted to make is that these kids don't read the textbook. Even if you force them to in class with some sort of activity, they come hunt and peck. I've just grown increasingly surprised at all the hand-wringing over textbooks and all the money that's put into them. And my wife's a college professor. She's seen the same thing.
When they're a test, aren't they tested on what they learned from the textbook?
No, they aren't. And if I give them reading quizzes where they fail the reading quizzes because they haven't read, then they get low grades. And then, of course, that's all the teacher's fault. And so you have to end up, it's kind of, I'm a...
Oh, we're back to the discussion of labor now.
Well, I'm caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, if the kids don't do well in my class, the dominant attitude today is it's my fault. If they don't read, even if I attempt to hold them accountable, it's my fault. I just think all this hand-wringing over textbook reading, and I've seen it at the college level, too. I've taught some at the college level. They do not read the textbook. So in a way, it's all this hand-wringing over this kind of, you know, the textbooks and what do the textbooks include. And the people who really care are these school boards and maybe people like ourselves who are participating in this conversation. But for the kids, these textbooks, they just don't read them.
All right, Keith, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it, and we wish you better luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And it's interesting, one of your suggestions, Jonathan Zimmerman, you point out that people are passionately interested in this, indeed, that on the bestseller list recently are two books of American history with diametrically opposite opinions.
That's right. Yeah, you have Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States, which, of course, he wrote many years ago, but after he passed away in January, it enjoyed a spike in popularity. And then Glenn Beck, of all people, pumped the book called A Patriot's History of the United States, which was in some ways a retort to Zinn. And that, too, entered the New York Times bestseller list. So they're both on the list at numbers 12 and 15, respectively. And I have two adolescent kids, and I would much rather in their history class that the textbooks be both a people's history and a patriot's history than any single textbook, because I think that if they, that is my children and others, were forced to compare these interpretations, I think they'd get a better idea of what history actually is and does. Think about the way that we teach, say, math or science. Even the worst math teacher on earth, presents a puzzle, some kind of equation. You couldn't teach math without a puzzle, even if you wanted to. Of course, history is a puzzle as well. And yet we don't let the kids in on that secret typically.
Yeah,
and
I think the difference is that in math, most everybody agrees that 2 and 2 equals 4.
That's true. I think people more conversant with math would say that there's a lot of disagreement about how we get to those answers and ultimately what the answers mean. But yes, there is a correct answer. And in history, often there isn't.
Mm. Nor is there often time. This email we'll finish with from Doug in Kensburyport in Massachusetts. When I was in high school in the 80s, U.S. history only had time to get up to World War II, and then it was summer. I learned all about our founding fathers and our heroic action in World War II, then learned nothing about the Middle East and relevant economic principles like the U.S. invention of planned obsolescence until I got to college. I am floored to hear from my niece and nephew this has not changed one iota, and have come to question how much of this is a deliberate avoidance of political nuance and not simply a calendar issue. Anyway, thank you for that comment, Doug, and thank you, Jonathan Zimmerman, for your time today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Jonathan Zimmerman, a professor of education and history at New York University, author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and in Memory. His op-ed appeared in the Los Angeles Times, and you can find a link to it on our website at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation, and this is NPR News.